from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Airstrikes from Saudi Arabia hit the city of Taiz hours after Saudi officials had announced they were halting their nearly month-long bombing campaign against the Ansarullah rebel movement. U.S. President Barack Obama called on Iran to help find a political solution for the crisis in Yemen amid the massive ongoing Saudi bombing campaign that has continued despite an earlier announcement by Riyadh that it would stop. The Saudis had declared that their objectives had been fully achieved and called the operation a success, but not everyone agrees with that assessment. Among the dissenters is political analyst Dr. Bassam Abu Abdallah from Damascus University, who spoke with RT's Kevin Owen Wednesday.
First of all, I should mention that Saudi Arabia failed in its aggression against Yemeni people. Because if we will talk about the targets which they put 27 days ago, nothing happened. The President Hadi, he is still in Riyadh, and the Houthi movement is still moving and fighting against Al-Qaeda, and nothing happened except the human cost of the Yemeni people. At the same time, I don't think with what is the role of Saudi Arabia in internal affairs of Yemen. Yemeni people can talk. It's internal dialogue. I think the United Nations or international community should help. And Saudi Arabia should stop its terrorist policy in the Middle East, starting from Syria to Iraq to Lebanon to Yemen. This Wahhabi movement should stop. Should the international community tell Saudi Arabia that this kind of policy of extremism and hate and violence should be stopped.
Let's just focus for a second, sir, yes, on Yemen and try to work out what Saudi Arabia is doing here. This initial operation called Decisive Storm, we hear now, has ended. There's a new operation called Renewal of Hope, as they've called it. Is it a PR stunt? What is it? Because both operations look pretty much the same if you look at their aims.
I think generally Saudi Arabia now, if it will work in diplomacy, they cannot enforce its conditions. The situation is changing a lot inside Yemen. The Yemeni people more unified, and I think the Saudi family in the eyes of Yemeni people collapsed already. No Saudis, the role of Saudis is as a killer of most of Yemeni. So now I think Iran, Russia, maybe now Washington, we have heard some statements from the White House that they should help Saudi Arabia to find a solution. Otherwise, if Saudi Arabia will invade Yemen through ground troops, I think we will see what I can call it, the starting point for the end of the Saudi family. It's a very dangerous game. And Saudis should understand that there is nobody in the international community or either in the region supporting them. Maybe United States supporting this aggression because they want to sell some or to buy some weapons to Saudis. But at the end of the day, I think what President Obama mentioned in New York Times 5th of April for Saudi family and other Gulf states, that they should look to their internal affairs. At the same time, Saudis, when they are speaking about legitimacy of President Hadi, at the same time, they are ignoring the legitimacy of President Assad in Syria. So these double standards has no legal basis to talk. If they are afraid from independent state in Yemen, this is another question. I think they should to take into consideration that many things changed in the region, and one of the important things that Saudis should change themselves before talking about other states.
The humanitarian cost of the bombing has been high, with, according to the UN, about 1,000 confirmed killed, including at least 77 children, 3,500 injured, and 16 million now in need of humanitarian aid. China's President Xi Jinping delivered a speech at the Asian-African Summit in Indonesia Wednesday with the aim of promoting common development between the two vibrant continents and carrying on the spirit of the first Bandung conference, which was held 60 years ago this week.
The deepening cooperation of Asian and African countries could generate a 1+1=2 effect. We need to stick to the spirit of mutual benefits, win-win results, and mutual development. We need to deepen regional and cross-regional cooperation and promote liberalization of trade and investment.
The commemoration of the 60th anniversary of the first Bandung conference is being held in Bandung and Jakarta through Saturday. Bandung, the first large-scale conference of Asian and African leaders from mostly newly independent states, took place on April 18th to 24th, 1955, in Bandung, Indonesia. The 25 countries that participated represented nearly one quarter of the Earth's land mass and a total population of 1.5 billion people. This was then-President Sukarno of Indonesia who hosted the conference at the historic event's opening.
This is the first intercontinental conference of colored peoples, so-called colored peoples, in the history of mankind. I am proud that my country is your host. It is a new departure in the history of the world that leaders of Asian and African peoples can meet together in their own countries to discuss and deliberate upon matters of common concern. Success. In spite of diversity that exists among its participants, let this conference be a great success. Yes, there is diversity among us. Who denies it? Small and great nations are represented here, with people professing almost every religion under the sun. Buddhism, Islam, Christianity, Confucianism, Hinduism, Jainism, Sikhism, Zoroastrianism, Shintoism, and others. Almost every political faith we encounter here, democracy, monarchism, theocracy, with innumerable variants, and practically every economic doctrine has its representative in this hall. Marxism, socialism, capitalism, communism, in all their manifold variations and combinations. But again, what harm is in diversity when there is unity in desire? This conference is not to oppose each other. It is a conference of brotherhood.
On an historical note, 10 years after his vision gave birth to the non-aligned movement, President Sukarno was removed by a U.S.-backed military coup in 1965 that placed the brutal dictator Suharto in power for 31 years. Among Suharto's many deeds during his tenure was the slaughter of more than 100,000 people in East Timor. Residents protested in Ramallah in solidarity with Palestinian children held in Israeli jails. Participants also honored 15-year-old Khalid al-Sheikh, who was recently released from an Israeli prison. Press TV's Mona Kandil was in Ramallah Wednesday and filed this report.
The youngest Palestinian prisoner in Israeli jails, Khalid al-Sheikh, was released last Thursday after 4 months of imprisonment. Khalid was honored by Palestinian rights groups and families of prisoners during a protest in solidarity with detained children. The boy says the imprisonment has left sad memories for him, although the Israeli forces will never scare him.
I was with my friend walking in an area close to the separation wall. We saw the Israeli soldiers running towards us. My friend managed to escape, but I could not. Israeli soldiers beat me with gun butts on the head and also insulted and tortured me during the interrogation. I was hand-tied for hours in prison. I suffer anemia, but I did not receive any sort of health care there.
Human rights organizations say Israel continues to violate all rights and freedoms. Currently, some 200 Palestinian minors are held in three different Israeli jails. 25 of those children are between 14 and 15 years old, while dozens of them are aged between 16 and 17.
We are here to raise our voice loudly to support the children. There is more than 205 children under the age of 18 in the Israeli jails. They are arrested in a legal situation, living in a miserable situation inside the Israeli jails.
Some 700 Palestinian children are arrested and prosecuted in Israeli military courts every year. A majority of them are charged with throwing stones at Israeli forces and their armored vehicles.
Khalid al-Sheikh is one among thousands of Palestinians kept in Israeli jails. Although he's been released days ago, he has undergone terrible ordeal because Palestinians insist on the continuation of different forms of resistance against Israeli forces until the termination of the Israeli occupation forever. Mona Kandil for Press TV, in front of the building of the Red Cross occupied Ramallah.
Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister of the Russian Federation, held a public Q&A session Wednesday, taking questions from Russian media and people from all around the world. Among the many questions he addressed were the situation in Ukraine, U.S. and EU sanctions, the Iran nuclear talks, and the fighting in Syria. The two-hour session was broadcast live over Russian media from 5 to 7 a.m. New York time Wednesday. We now bring you excerpts from that conversation.
When we talk to U.S. diplomats, the greatest grievance that they have is the situation around Edward Snowden. This took place before Ukraine, and this is obviously a big reason for embarrassment for this. This is their major personal grievance against Mr. Putin. Well, Russia giving refuge to Snowden, do you think this was a big mistake, or was it a plan, a strategy, or was it just an opportunity that Russia grabbed?
This was an accident, 100%, and our president have explained the situation in detail. But I'm surprised, actually, that U.S. diplomats still ask those kind of questions, because in the past year, I haven't heard any questions like that from Kerry or from his colleagues.
Together with Mr. Venediktov, we went to an occasion hosted by a high-ranking U.S. diplomat, and they said, what about Snowden? That's why the situation is folding in the way it is.
You know, they kidnap our people around the world. This goes against the international treaty that we have. At least, at the very least, they should inform us that there is this person who is a criminal. Let's do something about that. But they just keep kidnapping our people. And just recently, we had another case like that. What about Snowden? He was on a plane. He was going through Russia. He was going to Latin America, Bolivia, or maybe Ecuador. And he was supposed to change planes in Russia, that's all, in Moscow. And while he was up in the air, they canceled his passport and made an official announcement about that. So we even had no legal ground to put him on a different plane. So he came out of the plane and asked for refuge, and we gave him refuge because he was being prosecuted, and there was the very ambiguous situation. There are people in the administration who realized that something was wrong, and actually those who demanded for his extradition were not 100% right. Many people think he's a hero. I think somebody even erected a monument to him. So this was purely an accident. And when we ended up in this kind of situation, there was no other choice, no other option left for us except to grant him this asylum. And since he decided to stay here,
so there is no there is no opportunity not to give him refuge.
Exactly, and this was a purely humanitarian decision. If he wants to leave, he will be able to do so.
In any case, there is something to be proud of. You know, as I hear our public relations officers and spokespersons, there are lots of complaints voiced by them, even about Ukraine. I'm going to refer to something you have said about Libya and Yemen. You said there are double standards applied in Yemen. You are saying that Ukraine does not follow the procedures. Even over the last hour, you complained about Syria, Libya, Yemen, and Ukraine. Are we a country of complaints? Are we always feeling like we are the affected party?
Wait a second.
You're upset about Snowden.
Why do you say I keep complaining all the time? You asked me what is our position on the situation, and I told you that our partners fight terrorism in the wrong way, and I gave you some specific examples.
You know, initiative is a very important aspect in the world, in Syria, in Yemen. I mean, being proactive. We are not being proactive in Ukraine or in Yemen or in Syria. We always feel like a raped woman because we are always complaining. Why are we doing this?
No, I don't agree. First of all, let's talk about Syria. Personally, I think we did a lot to make sure that the Libyan scenario will not be repeated in Syria. We stopped that from happening. We stopped military intervention in Syria. A situation would look very different if Russia and China endorsed the UN resolution on that. We vetoed it. We initiated the second round of talks, which just concluded in Moscow. And for the first time ever, the so-called Moscow platform was adopted. It consists of 10 points, and the opposition, and I mean opposition in general, not just one segment of the opposition, agreed on something with the government. And this provides the foundation for the UN, which was kind of doing nothing about Syria recently. We'll start doing something, and new contacts will start in Syria, and we made an important contribution to that. On Yemen, we did a lot for the current situation to come back to political dialogue. And we're not the only ones doing that. We have partners who share our approach in this region. So I don't want to boast in Ukraine. The Kyiv agreements and in September and in February, which superseded them, came as a result of Putin's contacts with Poroshenko. So we're not complaining. It's not like we're talking about victory.
Because the Minsk process has been at an impasse, and we know this is due to the actions of the U.S., and they're going to do this for as long as they want, for 2 years or 10 years.
I'm afraid that this is unrealistic. 10 years, even 2 years, is not realistic, because Ukraine is in a very fragile condition, and to keep Ukraine in this fragile condition would be risking that it can break and fall apart. And I think the Americans realize that, and they will never do that.
Mr. Lavrov, the S-300 that we decided to start supplying to Iran again, and the anti-missile shield are both defensive weapons. In both cases, the president says S-300 is a defensive system. It does not worsen the situation in the region. However, the anti-missile shield is the system that exacerbates the situation in the region. What's the difference?
Well, it's not different. Logics, it's not different rationale. We use the same rationale in both cases. First of all, the S-300 system is not the kind of weapon that you can use to defend against nuclear weapons, whereas missile defense is to defend against offensive nuclear weapons. S-300 is good to defend against missile systems, non-strategic missile systems, airstrikes, and so on and so forth. A missile defense is totally different missile defense directly affects the capabilities of strategic nuclear deterrent. And this is why we consider what Americans are doing so seriously. Politically, we explain our position, and practically, we take necessary steps to make sure that this missile defense system does not upset the strategic balance of forces in the world.
Well, can you just explain this? What about the possible supplies of the S-300? As far as I know, there has been no timeline so far, but do you think these supplies are going to exacerbate the situation?
What do you mean? In a sense that countries that want to attack Iran will think twice before they do so, before doing that. It's actually... What?
So they're going to supply drones to Ukraine in order to attack Iran?
I haven't heard that Israel is going to supply drones to Ukraine. These are just speculations, unconfirmed speculations. Let me say something about S-300. Barack Obama's response was very interesting. He said, I don't know why they haven't been implementing this ban since 2009. Yes, we asked them not to do that, but I did not expect them to last with that for 5 years. And then yesterday he said something totally different. He said this is wrong and talks are still ongoing. So it's the kind of situation, like you said, how can we trust our U.S. partners? Because they always change their policy, always change their position. We did nothing wrong. We just did that to stimulate Iran. This stimulation worked, and the new important progress was made. And so there is no reason for us to continue doing that. Now, as far as Yemen is concerned and this region in general, this demonstrates that there are serious risks, and we don't want Iran to be targeted by airstrikes, illegitimate airstrikes.
Carlos Mendes Mendoza from Mexico asks, why isn't Russia going to deploy nuclear weapons in a Latin American country to prevent NATO enlargement? And lots of Latin Americans are asking whether Venezuela is going to get a Russian military base. Another Brazilian user is asking, is there going to be a kind of a BRICS army? So what are we going to do?
As far as nuclear weapons are concerned, I think everybody realizes that any kind of activity aimed at proliferation should be stopped immediately. And by proliferation, I mean it's new countries acquiring nuclear weapons and geographical expansion. Americans, for example, violate the non-proliferation treaty because they have deployed their tactical nuclear weapons in 5 European countries. And NATO has a program which allows personnel from those 5 countries to be trained in handling nuclear weapons. This is a serious risk for the nuclear non-proliferation treaty. And we don't think that our security, the security of our country, should be ensured by sending our nuclear weapons to some other countries. As far as conventional forces are concerned, including the Air Force, strategic bombers, and so on, I'm talking about conventional forces now. We are interested in our armed forces being capable of performing necessary tasks all around the world, anywhere. This includes Navy and our strategic aviation, our long-range bombers, we use seaports, and we are open to have to set up bases in other countries. Our ships have visited, warships have visited Venezuela, and we want this to be regular. Having a base in the sense of a U.S. military base, having a fortress full of all kinds of modern weapons, stuff like that, we don't think this would be necessary in our case. But just being able to make a stay somewhere, refuel the ship, take some time off for the crew to rest, we would do that.
There are approximately 1.5 million missing black men in the United States, taken from their communities by a racist juggernaut that includes mass incarceration and homicide. Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford has more.
A new analysis of population data confirms what has long been obvious to every minimally conscious black person in the United States. A huge proportion of the black male population is missing, physically absent from the daily life of the community. Many are prematurely dead, but the largest group has been consigned to the social death of incarceration. According to a study by the Upshot Unit of the New York Times, when prison inmates of both sexes are taken out of the equation, there are now 1.5 million more black women in the country, aged 25 to 54, than there are black men. In some locations, for example, Ferguson, Missouri, there are only 6 black men physically present in the community for every 10 black women. In white America, there is almost no imbalance in gender among the 25 to 54 age group. For every 100 white women, there are 99 white men. There are more black men missing from their communities than the combined black male populations of Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Houston, Washington, and Boston. 600,000 of them are in prison, and that's not counting black male prison inmates that are younger than 25 and older than 54. The analysts estimate that roughly half, and maybe as many as three-quarters, of the other 900,000 missing black men have died before their time from diseases and accidents, and that 200,000 of them are no longer here due to homicide. Black life in America does not start out with these bizarre imbalances among the sexes. There is no gender gap among blacks in childhood. Roughly the same number of boys and girls are born, and the ratio stays stable until the teenage years, when the war of attrition begins mercilessly grinding down the numbers of black males. How else is this phenomenon to be described except as a war, in which 600,000 are held captive during their most productive years, 200,000 are killed by violence, and most of the rest go to early graves from accidents and diseases that cause far lower casualties among whites? The data show that U.S. society has become much more toxic for black men during the very period in which blacks were supposedly making such fantastic progress. The numbers show that the missing black men phenomenon began growing in the middle decades of the 20th century. The increasing ratio of black women to men is primarily a product of the age of black mass incarceration. The war of attrition is a race war, deliberately and methodically initiated by the U.S. government, the effects of which have been devastating to black society on the most fundamental level, stunting the formation of black families and the black American group as a whole by physically removing and eliminating the men. The data support a totally plausible, factually grounded charge of genocide based on international law. The U.S. government, through its mass black incarceration policies of the last half century, has been guilty of A, deliberately inflicting on the group, on black people, conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction, in whole or in part, as well as B, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. The facts bear witness to the indictment. So do 1.5 million missing black men.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.